From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, breaking down Michigan's primary election with the reporters.
Indeed, folks are pumped up to vote. We are looking that this is going to be over 2 million votes cast.
This could be the biggest upset I've covered in 20 years.
And the analysts.
More Democrats turned out than Republicans in the primary. Obviously, a lot of work to go to sustain that for the November general election, but that vaunted Democratic enthusiasm seems to be there.
Well, I think that you saw a lot of the candidates that aligned themselves with Trump do very well, from John James to Delina Epstein. However, I would urge great caution in thinking that same messaging is going to work again for them in November.
Plus, the holy grail of Great Lakes shipwrecks. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A record-breaking number of voters turned out for Michigan's primary election Tuesday, and they have spoken. At the top of the Michigan ballot for the GOP, Attorney General Bill Schuette bested Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly.
Well, it's time to win again, and it started tonight with a big win, and we will finish the job when we win in November.
And for the Democrats, Gretchen Whitmer topped Abdul El-Sayed.
We need a governor who knows how to get things done, who's ready to roll up her sleeves and get to work.
So let's talk results, turnout, and election night glitches with Michigan Radio Zoe Clark and from the Gongwer News Service, Zach Gorchow. Welcome to both of you.
Hello, Cindy.
Hello there.
Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed that post-election day fugue. All right, let's start. Zoe, winners and losers. Any surprises for you in the results?
Well, if we're talking about the gubernatorial race, no. This is not shocking. These are the two front runners. They were the most well-known within inside Michigan politics and things like that. But I think there were some questions about, particularly on the Democratic side, Sri Tanadar, who of course spent millions and millions and millions of his own money. I think one mathematical report shows that with all the money he spent, he ended up spending, you know, just per vote, just some sort of ridiculous number. Abdul El-Sayed had some sort of momentum in the last final few days, getting endorsements from big progressives, including Bernie Sanders here in Michigan campaigning. But in the end, it is Gretchen v. Schuette, which likely would have been the lead had we guessed, you know, a year ago.
That Trump blessing for Bill Schuette and for John James, the Senate candidate for the GOP, seemed to work for both of them. Did you have any doubts about the Trump touch?
I didn't, mostly just because we were in a primary election. And that's where folks who are, you know, hardcore Republicans and hardcore Democrats turn out. So, no, absolutely not. Schuette, I like to say, recently hasn't doubled down on the endorsement of Trump, but quadruple million infinity down. I mean, it seemed like any single time that he could put it out, he says that he's been endorsed by the president, Donald Trump. Now, what I think the big question is what does he do to move to the center? Does he try to move to the center in the general, or is the idea still to run as the Donald Trump favorite and hope that that, you know, gets turnout in November?
And Zach, on the other side, El-Sayed did not get that glow from the endorsements from Bernie Sanders and also Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Democratic Socialist from New York. As a matter of fact, every candidate she endorsed lost. So that tells us that that mainstream Hillary wing of the party, if you will, beat out the progressive Bernie wing?
Yeah, and I think if you look at a lot of the state legislative results in Michigan, it definitely bears that out. Abdul El-Sayed tried to nationalize this race, and it didn't work. Gretchen Whitmer ran really a by-the-book race to win the Democratic nomination. She assembled basically almost every union and key Democratic endorsement, from unions to Emily's List to Planned Parenthood. She had all the key players like Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan, the congressional delegation, behind her. And, you know, Abdul El-Sayed got all sorts of national publicity. But when it came right down to it, Gretchen Whitmer wasn't talking about, you know, super lofty ideas like no corporate money in politics or single payer. You know, her message was, I'm going to do some things for you that will help you right now. And, you know, the single payer idea, while it definitely appeals to Democrats and most Democrats support it, these results suggest they were aware that the idea that a Michigan governor was just going to be able to wave a wand and create single payer health care did not resonate. It wasn't something that people really latched onto. Gretchen Whitmer was talking about things like the roads, Better access to health.
Yeah, I'm sorry, the damn roads.
Excuse me.
Not just
better
roads.
Access to health care, improving schools, like really more ground level things. That's not what Abdul El-Sayed was talking about.
I want to touch on the 11th, Zoe, covering parts of Wayne and Oakland counties. Mm-hmm. This is the one who's going to replace retiring Republican Dave Trott.
Yeah.
Looks like Lena Epstein, who helped run Donald Trump's campaign in Michigan, won for the GOP, and Haley Stevens, who worked on the auto bailout for the Obama administration and was endorsed by Hillary, wins on the Democratic side. And this is, a lot of national analysts have looked at the 11th, that it could swing Democratic. Mm-hmm. Anything from the voting numbers yesterday that gives you a sense of who might have the advantage heading into November?
Well, I think this is going to go to, you know, how big the blue wave is, if there is going to be this blue wave. I would say the 11th and as well the 8th, maybe even more so the 8th, which is sitting incumbent Congressman Mike Bishop, who Alyssa Slotkin will be running against him as a Democrat, another woman. And so really what this, for me, watching will all be about is turnout. And if Democrats get turnout higher than midterms in decades, which is what they will have to do, because as we know, Democrats just don't turn out in the midterms like Republicans in Michigan do. Those two seats are something to be watched. Also, in terms of the Alyssa Slotkin, though, it's an interesting candidate going back to this progressive versus sort of establishment, you know, issue. She is running sort of as this hawkish Democrat, right? CIA experience. It reminds me a little of Connor Lamb when he won in Pennsylvania months ago. It's this sort of centrist Democrat, but who will not on the record or you know, will not say that they will vote for Nancy Pelosi for speaker if Democrats take back the House. So it's this interesting dance that many Democratic candidates are doing, which is kind of staying towards the center and the middle to not seem incredibly extreme come the general, but also not saying, hey, I'm going to stick with some of the establishment Democratic figures in D.C. who remain so unpopular among voters.
Zach, I want to switch over to something that clearly from your Twitter feed startled you, and that is the state Senate race, Senator David Kinesic in Michigan's 5th, appearing to be losing to challenger Betty Jean Alexander. Did you see that coming?
This could be the biggest upset I've covered in 20 years of tracking Michigan government and
That's
politics.
Huge.
It is shocking. She had what's called a waiver, which means she didn't have to file any campaign finance paperwork because she had said she was going to spend less than $1,000 on the race. Usually anybody who has that waiver is a dead person walking. They're a non-entity. Mm-hmm. She did not respond to any questionnaires to describe really anything about herself. There was no indication that anything here was happening. There's some chatter that possibly there was a big mail dump into the district, sort of stealth style, still working to confirm that, so I don't want to get too into the details on it. If this result holds, and David Kinesic has not, at least prior to this interview starting, had not conceded, if it holds, it is a shocking upset. David Kinesic was really something of a rising star in Democratic circles. He has been heading up much of the Senate Democratic campaign efforts. And you talk to Senate Democrats, and they are just flabbergasted by this. You know, these accidental elected officials, sometimes it really turns out to be a big problem. They are sort of a fish out of water. And, you know, I guess we'll find out what the deal is with Betty Jean Alexander if this result holds.
And the if. Now, Zach, that leads me to look at all the tweets you were sending out about trouble in Wayne County. You tweeted last night, this is a major, major debacle for Clerk Kathy Garrett. What happened in Wayne County?
Well, we don't know all the answers, but I can tell you what at least we observed, which is that late last night, there were some really weird numbers showing. One of them was this Kinesic race. There was another district where the result was completely at odds with what was expected. And then all of a sudden, you went from being at, like, let's just say 50% of the precincts reporting to 20% of the precincts reporting. Well, that is a sign of big trouble and the numbers aren't right. Then you start hearing, wait, these numbers aren't right at all. I heard this morning, this is unconfirmed, but it stands to reason, based on what we saw, that some of the votes were accidentally counted twice. And they ended up having to start over. A number of people were calling Rashida Tlaib the winner of the 13th Congressional District primary relatively early in the morning based on a substantial margin Wayne County's numbers were showing for her. And it appears she will win, but the margin now is only one percentage point. And it really appears to me that a lot of folks jumped the gun on calling her the winner. And remember, Wayne County still has to canvass these results over the next 2 weeks. And let me tell you, numbers in Wayne County, especially in the city of Detroit, move around during this canvassing period. And that's an 800-vote margin for Rashida Tlaib. And I would not bet my house on whether that margin holds or not. I think there's still some uncertainty there about what's going on in that race. And so, you know, Wayne County now has shown numbers that are 100% of the precincts reporting. But you talk to Democratic professionals, and they're saying things I've never heard, like, we're just going to have to see what the County Board of Canvassers does today. I don't know. I'll ask them, are these numbers right? Maybe. I mean, this is astonishing.
What do we know today that we didn't know yesterday, Zoe?
Oh, gosh, Cindy, that's a great question. That indeed folks are pumped up to vote. We are looking that this is going to be over 2 million votes cast. I think predictions were between 1.2 and 1.8, 1.8 being on the high end, million. We're over 2 right now. So that's big. And I think portends, if you are Democrats, that there is going to be some kind of blue wave. But of course, you know, as we all like to say, the only polling that matters is on Election Day. And I think the biggest thing is being unsurprised by the results that, you know, in 2016, both March 8th, which was the primary, and then, of course, in November, lots of people were surprised. I think this morning it was sort of a, oh, okay, it's kind of what we predicted happened, right? I don't want any political reporters to be complacent and go, oh, right, we're back in the prediction business. But I was sort of shocked that we weren't shocked by it, because election post-mornings have been so interesting the past few years.
Final few seconds, Zach, what are you going to most closely watch as we look to November?
I mean, it's got to be the governor's race. Mm-hmm. This is the whole ball game. The Democrats absolutely must win the governorship to retain relevancy in the state of Michigan for the next decade. You can talk about the congressional seats, and that's all nice. You know, they've got uphill fights in both houses of the legislature. The Whitmer versus Schuette race is the ball game. If they lose that, you're looking at Michigan being more like Ohio, more of a red state. Mm-hmm. This is going to be an absolute all-out battle. Voters are going to be sick of these candidates and negative ads probably by mid to late September. This is something Bill Schuette's been building toward for almost 30 years. He's not going to leave anything on the table. Gretchen Whitmer is a tenacious campaigner. She's shown herself that, you know, she knows how to win a big-time statewide race and by a big margin. She's a tenacious campaigner. This is going to be a really fascinating race to watch.
Zach Gorchow from Gongwer News Service and Michigan Radio's Zoe Clark, thanks so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you.
Later in the show, we'll talk strategies, possible running mates, and more as primary winners look ahead to the general election. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk our state's history. And today, we're taking you way back, summer 1679, and it was on this Friday, 339 years ago, the French ship the Griffon appeared on the Detroit River. It was the first large-scale European-style sailing ship to reach the shores of what would eventually evolve into the state of Michigan. But little did its crew suspect that this ship would soon become the holy grail of Great Lakes shipwrecks. Here now to explain further is the director of the Michigan History Center, Sandra Clark. Sandra, welcome back.
Thank you.
It's always great to talk history with you. And from West Michigan, pleasure to welcome back to the program author and Great Lakes shipwreck hunter Valerie Van Heest. Hey, Valerie, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to let everybody know right now, starting from square one, that the ship is Le Griffon, if you're French. But we are from Michigan, and just so we don't have to be pretentious and pretend we really do an authentic French pronunciation, we're calling her the Griffon. Is everybody good with that?
Yep. That works.
You bet.
All right. Sandra, I want to start off with just who built the Griffon and where, because I'm pretty sure she did not sail up the Niagara Falls to get to the Detroit River.
She certainly did not. René Robert Cavalier de La Salle is the Frenchman who, I won't say he built the Griffon technically, but he's the man who had the Griffon built just this side of Niagara Falls, because obviously there was no well and canal back then, so you couldn't get from Lake Ontario to Lake Erie. So this is his way of opening up the western part of the Great Lakes to exploration and to what he was really interested in, which was making some money.
And remind us what his ultimate quest really was.
his legal ultimate quest is to find the Mississippi, maybe a route to China, although by then Marquette and Joliet had pretty well found that the Mississippi did not go west but went south. But he's out looking to expand the French Empire, explore new territory, new contact with the Native Americans. And along the way, there are these things called furs that he's hoping to make some money off of.
So finding that Northwest Passage to maybe get to China and Japan is one thing, but meantime, there's a lot of money to be made with those furs.
Yes.
Okay. So, Sandra, here we have on this Friday, 339 years ago, La Salle makes his way through the Detroit River and then what, keeps going north?
He goes north to the Straits of Mackinac. We know he makes it there. He stops there. Then he goes on over to Green Bay with the Griffin. And there he does something he wasn't supposed to do. He trades with the Odawa Indians for some beaver furs. He was only authorized actually to trade for bison, I believe. But so he gets a load of furs. He has supplies. He puts them on the Griffin and tells his men that are on the Griffin to head back to Mackinac, and that's where they're going to store these things over the winter.
Okay, so Valerie, then he's take it from there.
Yeah.
What happened next?
The Griffin left what we would consider the islands off Door County today to head back through the Straits, and the ship was never seen again. And that made it the first shipwreck on the upper Great Lakes and a mystery that has resounded for the last 300 and plus years.
Goodness. And of course, there's no radio distress calls. You probably don't have a lot in the form of knowing what was happening weather-wise at the time.
Yeah, well, we do know from LaSalle's account that shortly thereafter, either between 24 and 48 hours after LaSalle, who took some canoes and some men heading south to try to begin his exploration of the Mississippi, we know that a storm came up, and we know that LaSalle was worried for his ship, and indeed he should be because, you know, it was never seen again. Word, of course, traveled slowly back then, and it took months and years for the stories to come out. And one story did come out that the natives that would be now in the upper peninsula of Michigan did, in fact, see the Griffin, communicate with the crew, warn them not to go out in what the natives knew was a brewing storm, and yet they didn't take that advice and they sailed out from northern Lake Michigan. And so some would believe that the Griffin sank somewhere in Lake Michigan in the northern part of the lake and has yet to be found.
And Sandra, as we were saying, this has become kind of the holy grail of Great Lakes shipwrecks?
It has. I think there's some romance to it. And of course, not too many years ago, another ship that LaSalle had built and was using, this one down off the coast of Texas, was actually found. That's the La Belle. It ran aground, so it was buried in mud, but something that could be recovered and is now in the Texas State Museum. It's a fantastic exhibit, but I think that really reunited that, well, if that could be found, maybe the Griffin could be found too.
And Valerie, you're a Great Lakes shipwreck hunter. This is what you do. This is your passion. You've written about Great Lakes shipwrecks. Mm-hmm. Where do things stand as we speak right now in 2018?
Well, interestingly, in the Great Lakes, there is a whole contingent, truly a small group, but groups in every Great Lakes who make it their mission to search for Great Lakes shipwrecks. And there have been a number of people who have wanted badly to find the Griffin. It would be the most famous, you know, most renowned discovery if it could be made. And over a period of, probably 100 years now, there have been almost two dozen claims of discovery, some very outlandish, some we knew weren't correct from the beginning, others that were looked at with great interest. But ultimately, all but one of them have been discounted as being not the Griffin.
You say all but one. What? Which one?
All but one. There was wreckage found on the western shore of Manitoulin Island, first recorded by a European cartographer as laying there in the 1820s. And that took some further interest in the 1890s when skeletons were found near this wreck, six of them, and there were reportedly six crew on board the Griffin. And it took until the 1930s for an explorer to kind of connect the dots and say, well, we've got six skeletons and we've got a piece of a wreck, and that wreck has been there for a long time. Maybe that's the Griffin. And there were some tests done by a French archaeologist, and there is some indication that these remains could have been there as long as 1679, but it's never 100% been proven to either be the Griffin or not be the Griffin. So that's a mystery that lingers.
And when you think of scenarios that could have led to the wreck of the Griffin, do you think there is wreckage to be found?
Well, you know, the oldest shipwreck in the Great Lakes that has been found is the Ontario. Ship called the Ontario sank in Lake Ontario in 1781. And that was found by a team of explorers in New York. And that ship is in very deep water. The masts are standing. The hull is intact. There's even glass in the stern gallery windows.
Wait, stop. And, it's been there that long and there's still glass in the windows?
There's still glass in the windows because of the depth and the condition of sinking. But when I learned about that from my friend Jim Kennard, who found that wreck, it kind of convinced me that ships were well crafted back then. You know, we hear the expression, they always made things better in the old days. Well, this ship survived now more than 250 years. Why couldn't the Griffin survive 350 years? It could still be out there.
Sandra, if it's found, if the Griffin is found, who gets it? Michigan, Canada, France, who gets it?
The French claim that it was a ship of state, meaning like a warship, and under international law, you never give up possession of that. So they would claim possession of it. We had talked to them at one point not too many years ago, and we would probably have an agreement that we would acknowledge it was theirs if it were found in Michigan waters. Michigan bottomlands, and Michigan is the state that would be dealing with it. Wisconsin bottomlands. Wisconsin is the state. Canada could be, depending on where it is. But the French would definitely claim ownership. What they did with the LaBelle was a long-term agreement then with Texas, so that the ship remained in the United States, but France's ownership was acknowledged.
So you give a hat tip to the French and keep it.
Yeah. A nice, small international agreement, probably. But we're a long ways from anything like that happening at this point.
Well, fascinating, fascinating story. Sandra Clark, Michigan History Center, and shipwreck hunter and author Valerie Van Heese. Thank you so much for explaining the saga of the lost ship, the Griffin, the holy grail of Great Lakes shipwrecks, which first appeared off the shores of what would become Michigan on this week in 1679. Thank you so much.
It's been fun.
Thank you.
From Yemeni lamb to Polish pierogi, Metro Detroit is home to a rich, rich variety of international cuisines. One cuisine, though, that's a little harder to find here in Michigan is Filipino food. Dorothy Hernandez is trying to change that with Serap Detroit, a pop-up dining experience that serves Filipino-inspired farm-to-table food at events all over Metro Detroit. Dorothy Hernandez joins us now. Dorothy, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, Cynthia. Thank you for having me.
So talk to us first about the journey, your personal journey from Chicago, where you were surrounded by family and a very vibrant Filipino community. And then you come to Detroit.
Yeah, so I've lived in Detroit for a long time now. I first moved here in 2004 when I was working at the Detroit News. In 2009, I wanted a change in my journalism career, so I joined AmeriCorps. So I did a year of service at Gleaners Community Food Bank. That's when I really got to know the community. We worked a lot with urban farmers.
What about the Filipino community in
Detroit? Oh, yeah, so there's no Filipino community. Well, at least that I found at first, but
unlike what you had grown up with and what you'd known.
Yeah, yeah, so a lot of my family is still in the Philippines, and some of them are dispersed around the U.S. You know, like food is such a central part of Filipino culture. Like every party you go to, you eat when you get there, you eat while you're there, you eat when you leave, you bring food home. I mean, food is everything. When I moved to Detroit, I was really missing like that community. I told my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband and the co-founder as well of Syrup, he's a chef. So I told him, hey, you know, pop-ups are, you know, a really great platform for people who don't have a restaurant but want to try new culinary concepts or experiment with menus or anything. So I said, I really see a void with Filipino food in Detroit, so let's do it. I actually didn't learn how to cook until I was out of college and I had lived at home. So I just asked my mom, can you teach me how to cook adobo, which is a soy sauce and vinegar based soup. And then when I moved, I was able to like make these things for myself. But I didn't want to eat like a whole pot of food myself. And, you know, I'm just a home cook. So collaborating with my husband really helped me.
Who is a chef.
Who's a chef.
But he's not Filipino.
He's not.
All right. So you almost, you're bringing a blend of traditions to Syrup.
Yeah. So we really bonded over our love of food. And he went to the Philippines with me last year and like spent time with my family. And together we learned a lot. The Philippines has 7,000 plus islands. So we would go to places, and I had never even heard of some of the dishes that we would have. For example, we went to this area called Tagaytay, which is a few hours south of Manila, where my dad is from. And cattle is really big there. So they have a soup called bulalo, which is a beef-based soup. And then we went to Bicol, where my mom is from, which is about 9 or 10 hours away from Manila. And the crops there that are really big are coconuts and pili nuts and chili peppers. So Filipino food, to most people, doesn't conjure up memories of spice, but in Bicol it is because
the spice is there.
Yeah, chili peppers are big there.
So you and your husband decided, all right, we're going to do the pop-up, and it is Syrup Detroit. What's the significance of the word Syrup, S-A-R-A-P?
Yeah, so it means delicious in Tagalog, which is the main language spoken in the Philippines. That was the easiest part of doing the pop-up, I think, coming up with the name.
and the idea is you want to kind of go around Southeast Michigan. You feel like you're kind of spreading the word?
Yeah, that's really what I like to do, like raise awareness. Over the years, the concept has really evolved. At first, I was trying to do kind of like the homey stuff that my mom taught me and what I was used to. But then I realized, you know, people are not going to want to come. I get a lot of comments like, well, why would I get your food if I could just go to my parents' house and get it? So over the years, we've really tried to like think of different ways to put our own spin on it, because we don't want to be like, well, my version of adobo is better than yours because it's refined and elevated. Like, that's very insulting. So I just want to do a version that is delicious.
Well, are you aiming Syrup Detroit at the Filipino community in Michigan, or are you looking to bring in new people under the tent?
In an ideal world, I would love to appeal to both. As I mentioned before, I only knew that one Filipino person. So it was kind of funny. Like, after I started doing the pop-ups, I met so many Filipinos. They just came out of the woodwork. And it has just been so amazing to get support from the Filipino community. And a lot of times they'll ask me, you know, this is so great. Will you open a restaurant? You know, thank you for doing this. There's not a lot of Filipino restaurants around here. To get that support and have the same Filipinos come each and every time is amazing. And then I feel like diners in Detroit, you know, they have an open mind and they're willing to like try new things. So when they see that we have a pop-up, I'll meet a lot of new people too coming to our pop-ups. So it's like a nice balance.
Now you're getting asked by people, hey, what about a brick and mortar restaurant? Do you think that that could be in your future, or are you happy with taking the pop-up route?
Right now I'm really happy with the pop-up route because it's definitely not about making a lot of money. I also do a lot of freelance writing on the side, and I do a lot of stories about restaurants, and I know it's a hard industry. Like, the failure rate is so high, and then you just spend morning, noon, and night, hours, nights, weekends doing work in the restaurant. And at this point, like, my husband and I don't want to do that. We want to, like, have fun with the pop-up, you know, share a love of food, but still be able to enjoy our weekends.
How many do you want?
It really varies. Like with pop-ups, I mean, you're bringing everything. You're bringing the pots, the pans, the food. I mean, it's basically catering. So doing that in the winter is not fun. So, you know, it's kind of like the luxury that you have by doing pop-ups. You know, you could be like, well, it's December and I don't want to do a pop-up, so I'm not going to do one this month.
What adjectives would you use to describe the Filipino culture and its food?
Oh, so
you're a writer. So.
Yes. The word that really comes to mind is generous and hospitable. My husband, he was blown away by just the hospitality they encountered when we were in the Philippines. And that's just how Filipino people are. They'll give you the shirt off their back. And then with the food, I would say it's very complex. The Philippines have been colonized so many times over the years. There's so many influences. You have Chinese and Malay and Spanish, and then you have American influences. So it really combines for this very complex and flavorful and delicious cuisine that I just love and I want to share with everyone.
Dorothy Hernandez, co-founder of the pop-up dining experience Serap Detroit. And as mentioned, there's a link to their website with future dining dates by just going to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Thank you so much for being with us and sharing your passion.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Up next, with the primary behind us, we talk strategies going into the general election.
Politics hasn't changed that much since the ancient Greeks. If you want something from somebody, up to and including their vote, walk up to them, shake their hand, and ask them for it.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Now that the primary election has shaken out the winners from the losers, those winners are instantly turning their attention to the November 6th general election. Let's talk strategies, campaign messaging, and possible running mates. With us now, Matt Marsden, a Republican strategist. He's Director of Public Relations and Government Affairs at Rev6 Data Systems. And Adrian Hemond, a Democratic strategist and the CEO of Grassroots Midwest, a political consulting firm in Lansing. Adrian, what do we know today that we didn't know yesterday?
Well, the vaunted Democratic enthusiasm seems to have materialized last pretty much across the board, including in some areas you wouldn't necessarily expect. More Democrats turned out than Republicans in the primary. Obviously, a lot of work to go to sustain that for the November general election, but that vaunted Democratic enthusiasm seems to be there.
All right. And on from your perspective, Matt.
I think the turnout was substantial. I think that looking at somewhere in the range of 100,000 more votes cast for governor by Democrats than Republicans is fairly significant. I think it's an indication that we're going to have a higher than ever turnout in November. I think that I don't know the exact date, but I believe the turnout model for this primary was since 1970. It hasn't been that high. So 2002, it was 1.7 million. It's upwards of 2 million that participated yesterday. So I think that that's really an indication of people's angst and maybe frustrations.
So given that all kinds of campaign messages have been tried and tested and now we have results. So on the GOP side, Matt, what messages worked and what didn't?
Well, I think that you saw a lot of the candidates that aligned themselves with Trump do very well, from John James to Delina Epstein. However, I would urge great caution in thinking that that same messaging is going to work again for them in November. Mm-hmm. I think that that's they best be careful to not too closely align themselves, unless they're planning on trying to recreate what Trump did and build that exact coalition. It could be very dangerous for Republicans to tie themselves to that.
All right, flip over to the Dem side, Adrian. What messages worked and what didn't work so well?
You know, I think a lot of what worked best on the Democratic side was less tied to messaging than it was to tactics. However, what I will say is that, you know, Gretchen Whitmer did a really, really nice job of laying out a message that could appeal across all the various constituency groups in the Democratic Party. She got a slow start with that, but really that full spectrum sort of messaging, talking to pro-choice women, talking to African-American voters in the urban areas, you know, talking to people in the environmental community, really being a broad-based candidate was the right move for her, and it paid off.
And Abdul El-Sayed appeared to be gaining some late momentum. He had the endorsement from Bernie Sanders, but ultimately there was not a progressive wave. So, Adrian, what does it mean going into November for Democrats?
Well, look, Gretchen Whitmer is a very progressive candidate. Maybe this is just me with a get-off-my-lawn moment, but I think it's very funny that we're at a moment where there's a section of folks in the Democratic Party that think that Gretchen Whitmer, of all people, is not progressive enough. Gretchen's pretty progressive. And so I don't read too much into that. I mean, there's certainly a lot of energy on the left wing of the Democratic Party right now, but a lot of those people turned out for Gretchen. A lot of them voted for Abdul as well, which was a very reasonable thing for them to do. But Gretchen got a lot of those votes.
All right. Let's talk about the Trump factor. Brian Kelly said in his concession speech, this is President Trump's Republican Party. So, Matt, let's talk some more about these. Not only Bill Schuette, but Republicans up and down the ticket this fall. Is that a good thing or a liability?
I think that the Republican Party, the Trump Republican Party, if you will, is not as inclusive or open to the independent and more moderate centrists in the GOP. So I think, yes, while it may be Trump's party right now, I do believe that that could have a negative adverse impact on how this goes for Republicans in November if there's not some consideration taken to the large number of women that came out to vote. And these women have been angry and upset since we saw the marches in Washington. We saw women winning both on the Republican side but the Democrat side. But I think that independents, African-Americans, and women that may be set out of the election in 2016 are going to participate in the general election this year. And I think that Trump Republican Party concept may not be the most practical way to go about winning general elections.
So how does Bill Schuette pivot to be more attractive to these independent and moderate voters after being really doubling, tripling down on the president's endorsement for all these months?
It'll be very difficult for him to do so. He's taken some very hard positions, and Republicans tend to have these. This was a really rough primary for Republicans. It got very brutal, and there's a lot of kumbaya that probably needs to start happening today. And you saw a great division in the gubernatorial race between Patrick Kolbeck and all of these guys taking a faction away, right? And Schuette here at the 50 taking what I would consider the traditional GOP base. And then you see kind of all the other diversity amongst the party divided up amongst Hines and Kolbeck and the others that were there, and Kelly to a degree.
All right, Adrian, how would you advise Gretchen Whitmer as you look ahead to November? What should be her main focus areas?
Well, one of the things that you noticed last night, and I think this is something that she needs to repeat, Gretchen Whitmer won all 83 counties in this primary. Is she going to win all 83 counties in the general election? No. But running a broad-based strategy where, yeah, you're going to lose some Republican counties, how much are you going to lose them by? Are you going to lose them by 10 or 15 points, or are you going to lose them by 40 points? Can make all the difference in this election. You need to turn out your voters in Detroit. You need to turn out, you know, your progressive women voters. But ultimately, you need to lose by less in some of these Republican areas while you're turning your base out. So if she can execute again on an 83-county strategy and, you know, take your lumps in Ottawa County, but don't lose it by 40 points, you know, lose it by a smaller margin, and then turn those voters out in those core Democratic constituencies, I think she should prevail.
Which leads me to ask about running mates, because that's part of that. What should each candidate look for in a running mate? And do you have any specific names in mind you think would fit that, Matt?
I'm not sure I have anybody specific in mind, but I think that Bill Schuette needs to look to somebody that maybe appeals to, as I said, the more independent, centrist Republican voters, those folks that are what we categorize as ticket splitters, that can soften some of his more far-right positions that he's taken during this primary and some of the things that he's done as Attorney General in regards to same-sex marriage, other issues that are going to be more
more relevant in a general.
Well, toss out a couple of four instances if you think of Michigan Republicans.
I don't believe it'll be Brian Kelly. I think we've got a little bit too much problem there. I may look to a female. I may look to one of the senators, Shoemaker. I don't know. I would look for maybe a more middle-of-the-road female.
And over to you, Adrian. What do you think?
As far as the Democratic side, enthusiasm is one of the things that Democrats have really picked up on that they need to be able to rely on. It wasn't there in 2016. They need it to be there in 2018 to capture the governor's mansion. So I think more than, you know, traditionally the Democratic Party would be looking at things like demography, race, geography. I think those things are important. I think the most important thing is somebody that can really energize people and somebody that's willing to do the work. Running for statewide office of any sort is an incredible amount of work. It's sun up to sundown, frankly, probably before sunup till after sundown. And you need somebody who's willing to do that work with a smile on their face and really make that personal connection with voters. You know, for all of the mass communication tactics that folks like myself and Matt engage in, politics hasn't changed that much since the ancient Greeks. If you want something from somebody, up to and including their vote, walk up to them, shake their hand, and ask them for it.
Just because I'm curious, do you have any names? Same question I had for Matt. So anyone on the scene that you think could fit that bill?
I think there are a lot of people that would be great. You know, if you're looking in Southeast Michigan, I really like the idea of Garland Gilchrist. I don't know if he's going to be the pick, but I think that that's somebody that could really connect with some of those core Democratic constituencies. So that's sort of my dark horse that I'd like to see picked, I guess.
All right. Let's talk about the Senate race. Matt, if you were advising John James, West Point grad, Iraq War combat vet, what would you tell him he needs to do to beat Debbie Stabenow?
Distance yourself from the Donald Trump endorsement. Play up your military background, play up your business background, speak to women voters, and Debbie's going to be a very difficult candidate to beat. We've seen the Republicans have challenges all the time, and John James needs to go and ask the Republican National Committee for all the assistance financially that he possibly can get, because we all know that Debbie is a fierce fundraiser, and she's a difficult candidate because she has constituencies in the agricultural industry which tend to vote Republican. She's done a lot for them. So I would just say that he needs to really play up his credentials in the military, service to country, and really be careful and cautious of how much he uses the Trump endorsement.
Adrian, does Debbie Stabenow have to change anything? Should she worry?
No, I mean, I think Debbie Stabenow is a formidable candidate. She's probably the best retail campaigner in the state. She's an amazing fundraiser, so she needs to continue to do all of those things that have served her so well in prior elections. This is a really, really tough beat. That's why it was so interesting to watch this, you know, pretty nasty Republican primary, particularly towards the end, because this is a long shot.
I want to know what congressional race intrigues you most, Matt.
Unfortunately, probably the Bishop Slotkin race. I think that you saw a tremendous amount of female turnout and interest in her race yesterday. You saw a closing of what traditionally is a much larger Republican voter turnout for Bishop. While he ultimately won in terms of overall votes cast, it got very close for the 8th Congressional District. And I think I would also look at the 11th Congressional District with the two female matchup there.
And what's your particular intriguing race, Adrian?
Yeah, I agree with Matt, but in reverse order. The NRCC is terrified of what's going to happen in the 11th Congressional District. If you talk to people in D.C., it shows. They're very, very worried about that, and frankly, I think that they should be. The 8th Congressional District, I think, is a little bit tougher row to hoe. You know, the realignment that's going on in our electorate right now seems to have taken more hold in Metro Detroit suburbs, and, you know, Livingston County is still in that 8th Congressional District. I think that Alyssa Slotkin's got a real chance, but you still have to overcome that Livingston County hurdle. That's a bright red county, and it could very well serve as Congressman Bishop's firewall.
What are you going to most closely watch as we head into the fall, Matt?
I think I'm going to watch what the ballot proposals are going to do to this. I think that we have a large number of very interesting proposals down ticket. That's going to generate a great deal of interest and probably drive turnout, especially with the gerrymandering, cannabis, all of these big-time ballot proposals that are going to draw voters out that may not really even care about the upticket, but some of these issues are very critical to them.
Adrian Heyman, last word. What are you going to watch for?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the ballot proposals, both because of the things Matt just mentioned, also the interaction of outside interest groups that fund campaigns on the ballot side and the candidate side, how they're going to distribute their money. Most of these ballot proposals are coming from the left, and so you'd think that some of these traditional Republican business interests would want to beat some of those back, but they've also got, you know, a state house that they want to hold control of. They want to hold the governor's mansion. They've got state Senate seats to win, and so how do those resources really get allocated between ballot initiatives and the candidates on the ballot?
Democratic strategist Adrian Hammond and GOP strategist Matt Marsden. Thanks to both of you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And just to clarify, the Free Press reports that turnout for yesterday's primary broke a record that goes back at least to 1978. Some video games take you into outer space, some perhaps back in time, let's say to World War II. Well, here's a mobile gaming app that keeps you right here in Michigan doing something that we know oh so well, getting ourselves up north and dodging potholes and more. Joey Stinson of Fenton is the creator of the Get Up North game, and he's here with us now. So, Joey, you have taken one of the biggest sources of grumbling in Michigan, and you've turned it into something that's fun?
Yeah, you could say that. My friend and I, back in March or April, if you remember that terrible snowstorm that we had where it was like icing all the roads, there was accidents everywhere.
I do.
My friend and I made a really great decision to go up north that day. And the roads got so bad because we're from Fenton. We were going up to Pinconning to like this fishing supply store. We ended up taking these back roads because the highways got so bad that people were getting accidents. So once we got off the roads, we kept hitting potholes, and it was like clearly like they were big potholes too. It was at that stage where it was like slush in the holes, but not fully ice. So the road was like really bad driving, and my friend was getting really frustrated. And so we were like, to avoid these potholes, he'd like drive over in the left side of the lane and then get back over. And I started making jokes about it, being like, every time he hit a pothole, he'd get -1 points. So for the rest of the trip, it was how many potholes could we avoid? By the end of that day, I was like, I'm going to make this into a game. And he was like, you do that, dude. Good luck with that. And 5 months later, I'm like, hey, guess what? NPR called.
So describe the game for us, Joey. How does it work? And what do you do to win?
The whole point is that you're a Michigander making the ultimate journey up north. You start off with a car, and you avoid potholes, deer, and construction cones while collecting pop cans for points. The more points you earn, the more things that you can unlock in the game. Like you can unlock a snow level, which is expert, and you can unlock an SUV and a truck, which comes with more like damage. Like if you hit a pothole 5 times with a truck is when your car finally breaks down, but it's only 3 with a car.
You've really thought this all out.
Oh, yeah. So much. From the beginning of this game to the end of this game, there's probably at least 200 variations.
Wow.
Originally it had buttons, like you just press left or right. And the more people that I was sharing this with, when I like finally was able to like show people and get them to test, they gave such positive feedback. Like, I've made things before as a graphic designer who worked for EMU Athletics and the Detroit Lions, where I've got a really passionate idea and I present it to people and they're like, oh, that's so cool. That's so nice, man. Good luck with that. And it's clear, like, oh, that wasn't a great idea. But when I started showing people Get Up North, everyone wanted to, like, contribute. You know, it'd be great if you could, a deer that could move. Or is there any way we get the game to go faster over time? Or I don't like how I have to press left or right. Can we make it where I just swipe? And so, like, I just listened to all these people give their feedback, and I kind of built the game that they wanted. And we've already had, like, over 1,000 downloads, over 20,000 impressions of just people playing. We've gotten a lot of 5-star reviews, and it's been unreal. It's been fascinating that so many Michiganders can relate to avoiding potholes.
They can indeed. So there's what? How many levels in the game that you have to collect your pop cans for to get up, move up a level?
So there's 3 levels. The first one is easy. Second one is novice. And the third one is expert. And the expert one is in the snow, of course.
And what, when you say up north, what do you consider up north?
I get asked this question a lot. I would have to say when we would take family trips up through my grandparents in Hoxieville, we kind of always thought up north as like right around Houghton Lake, because we would take US 23, and that's kind of where you had to get off 23. So we've always said that, but I've heard so many different things. I've heard Mount Pleasant, you know, I've heard a few other places, but for me, I think it's Houghton Lake.
And this is a 300-mile journey you're going to make in your Get Up North game?
Yeah, actually, if you get all 300 miles, because that's roughly about how many miles it is from the bottom of the state to the Upper Peninsula, which I would consider up north of Michigan. It's 300 miles, and you can beat the game if you play for 300 miles straight. And I've only had one person do it so far, and he was my friend, and he did it to prove a point.
Okay. So what's next for this app, for this game? Do you have ideas that you want to take this all a little bit further?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now I'm seeing like what all the feedback is to see if there's anything where people are like, I'm having issues with this, or I'm having issues with that, or I really want this, or a lot of people are asking for a certain feature. I'm going to look at, you know, the commonalities of what everyone's saying and then build the game that the people want. After that, though, I definitely plan on making another app called Traverse City Cherry Picker, which I've kind of started working on now. It's just a simple pick-me-up game, but with Traverse City cherries, because I love the cherry festival every year. And then if that one goes well, we were thinking about doing Great Lakes Freighter, where it just played the background music of the Edmund Fitzgerald song that every year comes out. You know, every year, November 12th, what's on the radio? Gordon Lightfoot, and I'm proud of that fact.
Can anyone play this game? Who is it for?
It's for everyone. I specifically, my parents who hate apps and did not let me play video games growing up, I was like, how do I get my dad to play this? So I had to create the game with in mind that anyone in Michigan who can relate to the experience of dodging potholes and returning pop cans could play. So I specifically made it for kids, for parents, for moms, anybody who could really want to just take part. And surprisingly, I thought the demographics would be, you know, 18 to 24-year-olds, but it's actually been 30 to 45-year-olds that have been truly downloading the app and playing it the most.
And it helps people just maybe take some of the stress down of sitting in orange cone land and orange barrel land. Where can people get the app, Joey?
So it's in the Google Play Store and it's in iTunes. You can go to getupnorthapp.com and you can see how to play the game, submit any questions, buy a t-shirt from us. We're selling a limited edition Get Up North t-shirt. And, you know, you can click the buttons. It'll take you to whichever store.
Well, Joey Stinson is the creative director of Chiatown Media and creator of the Get Up North app. Joey, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And that's our stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.